Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. There's a hormone that science has long overlooked, and yet it holds a key to our ability to heal, to feel safe and connect. And that peptide hormone is oxytocin. How do we harness the healing potential of oxytocin, not just as a molecule, but as a message of safety within the body? Now, this episode was inspired by a question from Linda on LinkedIn who asked, Dr. Amy, I've done years of therapy, but still struggle to feel truly safe in relationships. What am I missing? I will answer your question in this episode, Linda. To go deeper into the role of this powerful 9-amino acid peptide hormone in stress and trauma, I'm joined by Dr. Sue Carter, the world-renowned expert in oxytocin. For over 4 decades, Dr. Carter has studied this remarkable hormone, and in my latest talk I gave at a conference, Sue was sitting on the front row and told me afterwards, I want you to talk more about oxytocin and the trauma response in the healing journey. Oxytocin does play a central role in attachment and trauma healing, and her research has defined how we really understand bonding, not just emotionally, but physiologically. So, I want to do a whole episode on this small but powerful peptide. You'll learn the role of oxytocin and its partner hormone vasopressin in stress, why early life experiences have such a powerful and lasting impact on our capacity for connection and regulation, how chronic stress and trauma alter our ability to interpret safety, even in neutral or loving environments and relationships, practical tools for increasing oxytocin naturally, and what needs to come first for these tools to even work. Whether you're a practitioner or someone navigating your own healing journey, this episode offers practical information and tools to understand how the body creates its own pharmacy of healing hormones and the biology behind why safety in relationships is the foundation. Let's jump in. In regards to oxytocin, oxytocin is vital for attachment and that initial bonding. What are the things that can go wrong, Dr. Carter?
Well, the first place that this system starts is in, no surprise here, early life. It's a well-tuned biological system designed, if you don't mind that language, to protect us, but also to allow us to be adaptive so that we're not stuck in sort of a rigid format. We can adapt to different conditions, and the we here, it's ourselves or any mammals. We're incredibly adaptive. That's why we've covered the planet with our people, because we can live in almost any part of the earth, no matter how cold, how hot, we can find food and so forth, but we can also find relationships. The flexibility of this system is something we need to understand and take advantage of, maximize.
And I love how you're painting that picture of the adaptations and the flexibility that that gives us, because that is so much of what we need going into life, is the ability to be flexible. And so much of what we talk about when it comes to trauma, grief, all of that stuff, is it makes us rigid rather than being able to have that flexibility that we want. And so if a person had challenges in that early life, what are the consequences to their oxytocin system, and how might that show up later in their life?
Well, a super good question. Obviously, we don't have a lot of data because that would require following people through their lives. And the kind of work that I do, at least that part of it, measuring hormones and receptors, that has really not been done across the lifespan. We can do somewhat comparable studies in animals, and those studies suggest that early life is the most important time for epigenetically. We can literally change gene expression by what we experience in early life or what's done to us. This is the good news and the bad news, right? The good news is it's flexible. The bad news is it's flexible. Okay. So the ideal circumstances are pretty much the ones that our ancestors and humans have always lived with, which is some kind of a mother-child relationship, a father or another adult. It does not have to be the father, but the mother will almost always, in every culture, need support. So that support could come from relatives, from friends, from society, from whatever we can get our hands on. And in that context, then, the primary parent, as some people would say, has a huge responsibility to make the baby feel safe. This is much what it's all about.
And that's then what is the same thing in future relationships in life, right? It's the hormone that makes us feel safe.
Yeah. Oxytocin is a relatively modern molecule. Now, that's 500 million years ago, mind you. That's modern in a sense. And the exact version of the oxytocin hormone is around 1 to 200 million years ago, meaning that it first popped up when mammals evolved. Humans, the estimates depend on what you call a human, but that's only in the relatively modern time. Oxytocin was already there. It allowed the transition from our reptilian ancestors to modern mammals. And that gave us a molecule and a system that we could go to and use to allow us to form relationships with safe others. So the first safety signal is mom, but after that, any number of other individuals, depends on how you live, can enter your culture, into your life, and have effects on whether you feel safe or not. That's kind of the bottom line on the hormones functions in my mind.
So would it be safe to say that people who are not experiencing safety in the relationships in their life, that they don't have as much oxytocin activity? Or what might be happening with them?
So that's a wonderful question, isn't it? Is it the hormone, or is it what the hormone does that then reinforces how the hormone acts? That's part of it. We have data from people who have post-traumatic stress disorders. They have pretty low oxytocin, about half what we see in other people. But some of the people who have the symptoms of PTSD still have fairly high oxytocin, but they have other hormonal problems around the same system. They may have very high levels of another molecule that's related to oxytocin called vasopressin. And vasopressin is, in my mind, the most important stress hormone in the body. And what that does is put us into a state in which we can manage sudden change, fear. It's very adaptive also, but it's an mobilized kind of activation rather than a take it easy, be relaxed, restore, that sort of pattern. So you have more than one way to do things. And these hormones are like little tuning forks. They can allow us to move in and out of states. They're not causal. So people get confused. They want a medical answer to these kinds of questions, and it doesn't work that way. I can explain why if you like.
I would love that. Like, I just love what you've just said, because I'm of the same opinion where cortisol gets so much press, and yet that's not the most important stress hormone at all. And so absolutely, let's go there, because this is so important for them to understand that no, like, vasopressin is actually really important for this stress response. It should be more important than all the press that cortisol gets.
Well, absolutely. Cortisol, when we've done studies, really only gives you acute responses. It reflects acute responses. It's a way of mobilizing sugar. Of course, cortisol is a glucocorticoid, meaning it allows the body to make more energy, more sugar. But that's a quick fix. And the things that most people are interested in are not the quick fixes, they're the long-term, the chronic situations. If the animals are our best examples in this new study we've done with PTSD, but the basic finding is that if vasopressin is very high, people may be in a state of agitation, hypermobilization, or even shutdown using Dr. Porges' polyvagal insights, I guess we could call them. If you can't escape, if the body cannot get you out of the situation, the last-ditch effort is to shut down, to turn off all the unnecessary appliances, if you will, and work with the essentials of life, which are breath and heart rate and so forth. But the brain usually is not going to be optimally functioning under those conditions because oxygen has to get to the brain. We have to be able to use the cortical function we have. So if we're in a shutdown state, I think vasopressin is one of the molecules that puts us there, then we're really in trouble. We may dissociate. We may have symptoms that we would call schizophrenia or borderline personality. All kinds of labels have been put on these conditions. But in my mind, they're variations on a physiological theme. And they're adaptive in their own context, but not in the long term, not in the sense of having a good life.
Mm-hmm. They're on a spectrum, right? And so you can have anything from mild disconnect with that shutdown, or you can have an extreme disconnect and dissociation that can present with some of those labels. And so I love that you're bringing vasopressin into this conversation, because this is not something that we've been able to talk about yet. And this is a perfect example where the body needs to be able to adapt and move. And when it can't, that's when it goes into this shutdown response. Yeah.
So we are using other physiological markers now to try to untangle what's special about a person who develops what we call post-traumatic stress disorder or trauma or whatever. Their system has gone through something more radical than just extreme stress. And of course, there's a good guess that it started quite early in life, or that it was a long period of stress, not a few days, but maybe much longer, much more intense. We really don't know.
And when we look at a childhood experience, like that's exactly what it usually would be. It's not just an acute stress. We're talking about a chronic experience that someone goes through, and the changes then that happen internally, our body is adapting to that, right? With the flexibility that it is designed to do.
Right. And there are obviously going to be genetic differences, but a lot of the differences based on our animal work, my best guess is that if you want to make the world a better place, you need to start as early as you can. You need to nurture babies. I come to the notion that we should be actually paying mothers to breastfeed. You know, I came from a feminist generation. I was a working mother, so I'm not saying everybody has to stop what they're doing. But babies need high-quality care. It doesn't have to be a biological mother. Actually, historically, it probably was only rarely the mother alone. She always had somebody else there. It's just fascinating, anyway, that this system was so well designed that it could be changed. So if you have less parenting, you may become a more individualistic person, a more self-oriented person. Anyway, we have a lot to learn, because I think once we understand how the system works, we then have a chance of better helping ourselves as older individuals, as adults, or later in life, tune that system into a more optimal range. It's always going to be about safety. It's always going to be about being able to feel safe enough that you can take chances, okay? Not that you stay in one place frozen. That's not safety. Safety is being able to adventure out, to come back to some kind of secure base, which again can be inside of us, and it can be other people, ideally both.
Ah, you just gave us gold. And I'd love for you to say that again, and also in this context of the difference between what is familiar and what is truly safe. Because many people, we get stuck in staying small in something that's not really safe, but yet it's this false sense of safety because it's just familiar and change seems difficult. But yet, what is true safety is that secure base that you're talking about, where we don't stay small. We actually, it moves us to explore and come back to that secure base and go out and explore.
I think we're beginning to see some of the answers. We can't push ourselves beyond our physical limits. If we do that, the system starts to fragment. If we don't sleep, if we eat a diet that keeps us in a high state of arousal, sugar is not our friend, for example. Okay, sugar is really only our friend at the time of an acute experience. But chronic sugar puts the body into a different physiological state and we'll start to have inflammation. We won't be able to cope. So there are all kinds of things we already know, but we haven't quite, most of us, including me, haven't quite conceptualized them in deep biological terms or in terms of relationships.
As adults, then, what is the role that oxytocin is playing in our social relationships and our social bonding and our relationship with a partner or without a partner?
There's some nice research from a woman in Israel named Ruth Feldman. And what Ruth did was basically use the animal models that I had developed with highly social mammals and test them in people. And what she found was that the highest levels of oxytocin were actually in young couples in love, who were emotionally in love. She found similar high levels in mothers around the time of birth and in fathers. Okay. And she did a brilliant experiment in which she took gay partners who were having surrogate children, but adopting those children immediately at the time of birth. In fact, one father would be the biological father in most cases. The egg came from somebody else. The surrogate father who stayed with the baby, who became the mother figure, had higher levels of oxytocin than the father, the other parent, who was not primary caretaker. So this experiment proves, I think, for the first time, how important the baby is. So it doesn't matter if you're male or female. It matters whether or not you are around a child or an adult love object.
I definitely want to move into being able to cover some of the ideas that you have on how we can leverage oxytocin and be able to bring higher levels of activity of oxytocin into our brain, into our system, as adults?
Okay, I can tell you where people have found high levels of oxytocin being produced. During sexual behavior, especially at the point of orgasm, that's a high oxytocin experience. At the time of birth, as I've just said, being in love, being capable of feeling love, some other interesting things like exercise. Turns out that one of the ways to elevate your oxytocin is exercise. But in exercise, you also elevate vasopressin. And acute exercise is different than chronic exercise. And we just don't have as much information on how that falls out. So, you know, for what a normal person like me would consider intense exercise would be nothing to someone who's a marathoner. And the hormones tend to follow the intensity. People have talked about things like cuddling. To be honest, that's not a very powerful stimulus. It would depend on who you're with and how intense your relationship is. But oxytocin has this partner, the sibling hormone, vasopressin, and the two of them together create what I would call a peak experiences. Experiences that we remember or we experience at the moment as really special. You need both hormones for that kind of experience and a whole bunch of other molecules, of course. If you have only oxytocin, not vasopressin, over time, that probably would be associated mainly with relaxation, with feeling calm, but it's not the same. There's so many variants of human experience and human emotion.
One of the things that you said, Dr. Carter, was being capable of feeling loved.
Mm-hmm. That's a big one, isn't it?
Tell me more.
Yeah. Well, I wish I had the answer to that. Let me go back a step to why it's helpful to understand oxytocin. What oxytocin does for us, part of what it does is it allows us to have experiences that we're not blaming on ourselves or others or our body, but we're feeling them and interpreting them with awareness that there is a deep biology under here, under that situation, and that a lot of the things, you know, we're a very cognitive species, let me put it that way. We would like to think we're in control, but in truth, the body has a lot of control over how we feel. If you have a stomach ache, you just don't have the same capacity to perform as you do under other conditions. If you feel dizzy, you can't perform, probably because you aren't really getting quite enough blood to your brain. And so we have a lot of information coming from the rest of our body, and our brain is mostly interpreting it, and it interprets it in the context of our history, and that's where it gets a little complicated. If we have a lot of trauma in our history, we may interpret very benign things as dangerous or threatening. So we've got a conflict between what some people call top-down and bottom-up information. Oxytocin sits kind of almost exactly at the point of intersection between top down and bottom up. It's in the hypothalamus. It's in a part of the brain that's critical for autonomic, so it regulates the parasympathetic nervous system. It's critical for appetite, for temperature regulation, all the so-called hypothalamic processes are mostly under bottom-up control, but under, shall we say, optimal conditions, we may be able to exert top-down regulation as well. And I think that's what most of the people I know who are therapists are looking for ways to gain that top-down control. Many of them are realizing if they put the body into the story, use somatic information, they have a better chance of making this work. To put it simply, I can't just tell myself, don't be afraid. I can't be told by someone else, don't worry. All of those things actually do not help. What helps is to understand, not be afraid of our bodies, and find physical, I would say somatic therapies are really critical at this point. We're seeing how important that is compared to the talk therapy that was purely cognitive. So talk therapy works, but it probably works because it makes you feel safe. You can use music in some cases to get the same benefits. We have similar problems all the time. And the good news about having a big brain is we can do things like move away from danger, okay, anticipate. The really thing that makes humans special, if there's anything, is we can project the future better than almost any other species. There are other animals that have the capacity to project the future. And even rats can anticipate danger versus threat. But it's fascinating. Someone at she was at Rosalind Franklin University in Chicago. She found that oxytocin allowed rats to accurately predict the future. So real threats rather than ones that weren't real. And this is really, I think, what having a brain is all about. It's sorting out what's real. Like if you wake up in the middle of the night and you're suddenly flooded with fear or anxiety, the trick here is to figure out first kind of the cognitive interpretation. Oh, there's nothing to worry about. I'm not in the midst of a hurricane or a tornado or a fire. But then also to find ways to use the body to breathe, to go back to a relaxed form of physiological responses, to get our bodies back into a physiologically safe space. And that's hard. That's very hard because, as you said correctly, we're wired to deal with emergencies first. Our body is a first responder.
Could you explain the relationship between oxytocin and inflammation?
Yes, I'd love to try. Oxytocin's an anti-inflammatory. I don't know if you could compare it to others, but I think it may be one of, or perhaps the most powerful anti-inflammatory the body has. Vasopressin is pro-inflammatory, and there are many molecules in the body that are pro-inflammatory because, again, they're there to deal with viruses, infections, emergencies. But over time, these anti-inflammatory components, which can be either from inside the body or outside, are necessary to put out the fire. So I often use a picture of a fire extinguisher saying, look, if you don't remember anything else about what I'm teaching you about oxytocin, think of it as nature's fire extinguisher. And every single disorder that I know of that's chronic has an inflammatory component. And we need to tie this back to one more thing, and that is, it's not just the oxytocin molecule, it's the receptor. And it's that receptor for oxytocin in the context, and the most powerful context is social, in the context of social safety, that makes oxytocin have its magic. When people have tried to give it to people as a kind of treatment, as a medicine, and if the people receiving it were in a state of threat, had a high level of trauma throughout their lives, they actually felt not this relaxation, but they would go into defensive states, sometimes even aggressive. The molecule is not the secret. It's the body's state and the receptors for the molecule, the history, the context that determines how it works. This is why when I talk, I get almost always, where can I get some of this great stuff? And I have to unfortunately tell you, you're going to have to help your body make its own.
And maybe that's a good place for us to swing around to the end here. Where exactly is oxytocin made in the body, in the brain? Like where is it actually being made, and where are we focusing our efforts to make that area healthy?
Yeah, that's the answer is the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is subcortical. It's old. It's the point, as I mentioned earlier, of an intersection between the old body information from the brainstem. It's the connection for parasympathetic and sympathetic activity. I sort of think of it as a big command post with lots of electronic, or now we'd say just information, going out to other places in the brain. One answer is that, and this is some good news, I think, some of the work that Steve has done using a certain kind of filtered music, music that has prosody, has the same frequencies as a mother's lullaby, that music probably can talk almost straight to the hypothalamus. And in so doing, give you some relief. And people are using this. He has a company bought the rights to use his method. The company is called Unite, UNYTE, and they created something that is now called a safe and sound protocol. And people can get access to that. It's not super expensive. It's filtered music. They can put it on their phone and use it either when they're going into a difficult situation or during chronic conditions. But there's always a but. Like the oxytocin itself, like all of these systems, if there's a tremendous amount of trauma and the person is not in a safe setting, this is not ideal. And the safe and sound protocol is pretty safe, but individuals are advised to work with a therapist when they're doing it so that they have a ballast there, someone professional who understands how to help you sort of psychologically hold your hand through if you start to have feelings of threat or fear. Those will go away. They resolve themselves over time in most people. But that, to me, is one of the most promising things that's out there. That's a non-invasive vagal tone approach for more severe situations. People have used like intractable depression. They've used vagal nerve stimulators to go right into the body. That to me is unappealing because it's surgical, but there are cases where it's worked. And now there are non-invasive vagal tone methods that are on the ear. So those of you who know about acupuncture know there are points on the ear that are related to the autonomic nervous system. And there are ways to go into that system with auricular therapies. And probably almost all of the alternative medicine approaches that work because they're going into this system and allowing it to feel safer. So, you know, yoga or various other kinds of therapies of that sort in a safe environment can help the body get into a period of relaxation, to get out of that acute fear state and into something where the cortex can come back into the story and can start to make really rational decisions. If they don't have safe and sound right this moment, listen to music, listen to lullabies, sing, use your own body to help you move. I think of it as talking to the hypothalamus.
Okay. I like that, talking to the hypothalamus.
A couple of more practical things.
Please.
Reciprocal play is good. Get a ball and throw it to someone else. Use your body because you have all that muscle tissue, which, as we now know, the muscles and bones have oxytocin receptors on them. So there's an opportunity. These receptors are like addresses for the hormone, and it tells it where to go. The heart is loaded with oxytocin receptors, the autonomic nervous system, the immune system. So if we can play with others, though, and also this, somebody did this experiment years ago. I love it. They went to a nursing home and assigned people one of two roles to either give or receive. It was a random assignment. And then they just looked to see how long those people lived. These were very old people. The ones who were assigned to give lived longer and had less morbidity, less disease. So typical biblical wisdom here is it is better to give than receive, probably because of oxytocin. And that's what the reason I knew about that study. The woman who did it asked me to help measure oxytocin. The study itself didn't prove yet. She's sort of still working on it. But I think we're going to find that common wisdom is very powerful, and that's part of where we're going to find our answers. Knowing the biology is there just creates a whole different layer of knowledge and wisdom about why the things we already know work.
Now, to answer Linda's question, yes, what you're experiencing is incredibly common, and Dr. Carter's research helps us understand why. When you do traditional talk therapy, you're primarily working with the cognitive top-down part of your brain. But as Dr. Carter explained, oxytocin sits at the intersection between your thinking brain and your body's autonomic nervous system, those automatic responses in the hypothalamus. This is why you can understand your trauma and triggers perfectly, but still feel unsafe in your body navigating the world. And here's what happens biologically. If you experienced early trauma, as I define it in my book, your oxytocin system may be dysregulated and your vasopressin, that mobilization stress hormone, might be chronically elevated. This means your body is stuck in a survival state, scanning for danger, seeing threat everywhere, even when your rational mind knows that you are safe. Now, the beautiful news, of course, is that this system is flexible and you can change it. You can start by using somatic practices from the 21-day journey that create a felt sense of safety in the body, prioritizing relationships that make you feel truly safe, not ones that you have to convince yourself that you do or should feel safe, and even incorporating calming music that creates the environment that helps your body feel safe. Remember, healing is so much more than just understanding. Yes, we need psychological safety. We need to understand what's happening in our body. And it's also about having our body know it is safe, that inner knowing, that felt sense of safety. And if you would like to go deeper into creating a felt sense of safety and improve your relationships, I have resources for you. These links will be in the show notes. You do want to subscribe because you will want to catch the second episode I will drop this week that will be a high-yield 15-minute focused deep dive into the biology behind this episode and practical action steps. You also can order my Biology of Trauma book, How the Body Experiences and Holds Fear, Pain, and Overwhelm, and How to Heal. You can order it, and at the time of this recording, you will receive over $400 worth of bonuses because it's the pre-order window. Once it publishes on September 23, 2025, those bonuses will be gone because they are pre-order bonuses. So I will have the links to order it on Amazon or other bookstores and the link to get your bonuses. 21-day journey. If you're ready to create a felt sense of safety in your body and experience the decrease in daily physical pain, the 28% decrease in sleep issues and digestive issues, the 30% decrease in anxiety and depression that people are getting as they go through this 21-day journey, you will want to find the next one and join me. This is a structured sequence of gentle somatic-based self-practices that I guide you through. And I guide you through the essential sequence to safely open up stored trauma in the body. Safely open up. We have to create safety while we even open up stored fear, pain, and overwhelm. There are a few related podcasts that will be helpful to you. Episode 69, How Attachment Shapes Our Biology and Behavior. Episode 77 on attachment styles with Dr. Diane Poolheller, and a related YouTube video on addressing attachment trauma with a strong relationship to create a sense of safety. I am here to save you time and money by bringing you practical information that will help accelerate the healing journey. So take a moment to leave a review, because your feedback is how I know how to improve this podcast, bring you great content, and help others find information that can change their lives as well. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. Until next episode, lots of love.